Hello, this is Alton Banks from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And we'll begin this week's Triangle Business Journal with a reading from the Biz page. And under the heading of Surge comes the article, Amazon Effect Has Virginia Tech Feeling Overwhelmed. If you're a high school senior and you're heading to Virginia Tech, congrats. Now the bad news. The school may not have a bed for you. The school generally expects to bring in 6,600 for its freshman class, what colleges refer to as the yield. Every college goes through this as administrators try to balance the number of acceptances with how many students will actually enroll. But as the May 1st acceptance deadline, around 8,000 students planned to enroll. And the school, and Blacksburg itself, doesn't have room. So Tech is waiving the requirement that students live on campus. It's all looking at ways to incentivize students to start later. Hey, how about a gap year, or even start earlier? The school does have enough classroom space, and expects to add classes and faculty to meet demand. Louisa Havens Gerardo, Vice Provost for Enrollment Management, said, "Every day we thought, this is the day it'll die down, with the trend lines slowing down, but they never slowed. Administrators believe the surge is because of the new Northern Virginia campus it will build in conjunction with Amazon's HQ2. Many new students are interested in computer science and computer engineering, just the sort of jobs Amazon will seek." And under the heading of Need for Speed comes the article, Forget Buying a Tie. This Father's Day, get a Porsche. Father's Day is just ahead, and if you're thinking about how to honor that special biz columnist in your life, here's one thought. The North Carolina Museum of Art is having a raffle for a 2019 Porsche 911 Carrera, valued at $119,770. Tickets are $100, and the museum plans to sell 4,500 to raise funds to support programming. And the car is a time saver. It can top out at 191 miles per hour, which means Biz can get to work faster. And under the heading of Coming comes the article, Gay-owned businesses in the Triangle get a boost. This area's gay and lesbian businesses will get some support from the Greater Raleigh Chamber of Commerce this month. On June 12th, the Chamber's monthly dinner speaker will be Justin Nelson, the president of the National LGBT Chamber of Commerce, which is based in Washington, D.C. Nelson will address the importance of diversity and inclusiveness in building a business. Then June 13th, the Raleigh branch of the LGBT Chamber will hold an event about promoting economic growth for LGBT businesses. Adrienne Cole, the president and CEO of the Raleigh Chamber, will speak to the group about diversity initiatives, and Wells Fargo will share resources available for small businesses. The event is free thanks to a Wells Fargo grant. And under the heading of Interesting comes the article, Maybe It's Time to Hug an Engineering Student. Though university students in North Carolina are performing well during their enrollment and in years after, a troubling amount of them report feeling disconnected during their academic studies, especially engineers. 2019 Gallup poll examining the outcomes and experiences of students in the UNC system reports that only 33% of students strongly agree they felt cared about as a person. Those numbers were more favorable in some areas than others, with 36% of arts and humanities students agreeing with the statement. The worst average was reported for business and engineering, in which only 29 and 26% of students respectively felt cared about as a person. And under the heading of Music comes the article, Triangle Music Fans Have a Challenging Weekend. This past weekend was a tough one for local music fans. First, Hootie and the Blowfish were delayed by rain by 2 hours in their highly anticipated concert at Coastal Credit Union Music Park on March 31st. But at least Darius Rucker made it to the stage. On June 1st, the annual Band Together concert was thrown for a loop when the lead singer of St. Paul and the Broken Bones, Paul Janeway, couldn't perform because of health issue. The band will return to Raleigh August 29th, and tickets from the June 1st show will be honored. Band Together was formed after the September the 11th attacks and uses live music as a way to support local nonprofits. Thank you to the Broken Bones for performing an incredible instrumental set, and thank you to everyone who came to support our fight against child hunger with the Interfaith Food Shuttle Band Together set on Facebook. The fun continues. See you August the 29th. And finally, from the biz page under the heading of Tight Spots comes the article, Hillsborough Street will launch a new Raleigh parking strategy. Dramatic changes are coming in Raleigh when it comes to parking, and it's going to start on a corridor, Hillsborough Street, where parking is a rising challenge. By September, the city of Raleigh will roll out new parking meters and new prices designed to better manage parking in the Hillsborough Street corridor. More changes will follow, first at Glenwood South and then downtown. Matthew Currier, the city's parking manager, says the idea is to use technology to better manage the flow of parking. For example, parking along Hillsborough Street is free after 5 p.m., so that means an NC State University student can grab a spot at 5:05, head to the library, and keep the parking spot past midnight. That's great for the student, but bad for businesses yearning for spaces for customers. The idea is to provide flexibility in how we manage those corridors, Currier says. He also points out that the lots on NC State's campus are free after 5 p.m., so the city will raise its hourly rates from $1 to $1.50 and also extend the meters to 8 p.m. So, a price-sensitive student could still park for free on campus, create more spots for short-term visits to the businesses along Hillsborough Street. Turnover is critical, says Jeff Merrilson, Chief Executive Director of the Hillsborough Street Community Service Corporation. Each one of those visitors is a potential customer for all of our businesses. When somebody parks and leaves their car for 3, 4, or 6 hours, that's making it harder for another visitor to come. Currier said the goal is to have occupancy in the spaces of between 80 and 85%. If that reaches 95%, he says the perception becomes that parking is too difficult. Currier says the city brings in over $18 million per budget year from parking, and said that is likely to rise to around $20 million once the changes are implemented. Next, we move to this week's technology and banking page, and under the heading of Hiring Planned comes the article, Customer Plots Growth in Durham After Big Fundraise. Now, this is customer spelled with a K instead of a C. Armed with a new $40 million funder, a New York technology startup plans to expand in the Triangle. You'll see us planting the flag in a big way, says customer CEO Brad Birnbaum. Assuming Durham becomes the success we anticipate, I would see us growing significantly in the region. Customer develops a platform to expedite customer service at consumer-focused companies. The round, led by Tiger Global Management and existing backer Battery Ventures, increases its financing haul to $113.5 million, the company said. The raise will also help the four-year-old company build out a new office in Durham, Birnbaum says. The company's growth targets are aggressive. The company, at about 65 employees in the first quarter, has 115 today, he says. And if the Triangle talent pool is as robust as expected, much of its future growth will happen here. The plan is to hire upward of 15 people locally per quarter. And under the heading of Acquired comes the article, PE firm buys fast-growing Prometheus Group of Raleigh. One of the fastest-growing companies in the Triangle has just been acquired. Technology firm Prometheus Group, which ranked 6th on Triangle Business Journal's 2018 Fast 50 list, is being bought out by Genstar Capital, the company announced last month. Genstar, a San Francisco-based private equity firm that targets software, technology, healthcare, and financial services firms with more than $17 billion in assets under management, acquired the company from Francisco Partners, which acquired its majority stake in Prometheus back in 2016. Prometheus develops plant maintenance operations and optimization software and was founded in 1998. Currently has more than 300 employees. And under the heading of Cutting Staff comes the article, layoffs disclosed at Republic Wireless as former parent Bandwidth expands. As Bandwidth grows, a company founded within its own walls, Republic Wireless, has confirmed layoffs as it cuts its own footprint. Since spinning Republic Wireless out as a standalone company, Bandwidth has been leasing nearly 41,000 square feet of space to its once subsidiary at NC State University's Centennial Campus. But that's about to change, as Republic Wireless, the firm battling big-name brands such as Verizon and AT&T with Wi-Fi-based mobile phone plans, is shrinking. Via a securities filing, Bandwidth disclosed that it has amended its agreement with Republic Wireless, cutting the space it leases to the firm in half, from 40,567 square feet to just 17,071 square feet, effective June the 9th. Republic Wireless spokeswoman Sarah Siegel says the company had additional space at Centennial Campus apart from the Bandwidth lease. Siegel says in an email that Republic Wireless took additional space on the fifth floor last year and has been in the process of moving teams up there, meaning the space reduction is not as dramatic as it appears from Bandwidth's filing. Siegel couldn't immediately give a total footprint for Republic Wireless, nor could she say how many people were losing their jobs in the confirmed layoff round. They are not making that level of detail public, she says. They are a close-knit team and would like to remain as respectful as possible. A Republic Wireless statement said, "It is working with displaced workers to ease the transition. The changes enable us to continue to pursue our mission on a profitable foundation with annual revenues approaching $100 million. Meanwhile, it is yet another expansion story for Bandwidth, which, according to the new agreement, is paying Republic Wireless $225,000 in consideration for Republic Wireless's furniture, fixtures, and equipment. And also from the technology and banking page comes the article, Red Hat offers big carrot to CFO to stay past acquisition. As IBM works to close its blockbuster buy of Raleigh-based Red Hat, its soon-to-be subsidiary is trying to entice its top finance executive to stay. In a securities filing June 4th, Red Hat unveiled an agreement with its chief financial officer, Eric Shander, one that would mean a cash retention award if he decides to stay with the company after the $34 billion IBM deal closes. It's part of what's referred to as a special bonus program created by Red Hat to assist in retaining key employees in the period through and after the closing. The grant, which has been approved by both the firm's compensation committee and its board of directors, makes Shander eligible to receive $4 million delivered in two installments. He would get 50% of the six-month anniversary on the six-month anniversary of the closing date, with the remaining 50% on the deal's one-year anniversary if he's still employed at Red Hat. If Shander is involuntarily terminated without cause, he'd be entitled to any unpaid portion of that $4 million sum under the terms of the agreement. It's quite a big step up from the $450,000 base salary Shander inked when he was first promoted to the top finance spot 2 years ago. And under the heading of concerns comes the article, NC Bankers Push Back Against Lending Rule. A new lending standard, one labeled a major issue by community bankers in North Carolina, is closer to becoming a reality. That's even as local executives, aided by the North Carolina delegation, lobby for a pause on its implementation. If the new rule goes into effect, bank CEOs, such as North State Bank's Larry Barber, said it could hit small businesses particularly hard, especially if another recession hits. "We can't take risk without incorporating profitability into it," he says. "When you start having to write down loans day one in a recession, why would you make loans?" The concern rests with an accounting standard called CECL. That's Current Expected Credit Loss. Financial regulators have posed the standard instead of the current incurred loss approach. The standard, which goes into effect for the nation's largest banks in 2020, forces banks to book a loss on every loan on the front end of every loan, explains Peter Gwaltney, CEO of the North Carolina Bankers Association. The association has labeled this a priority issue. So, in a downturn in the economy, when banks are trying to recover on loans, this new accounting standard requires banks to book a loss on every loan. So, the motivation is to book fewer loans and contract the balance sheet, he says. And Gwaltney says the accounting standard disproportionately affects community banks, such as North State, as it adds additional costs. He expects many small institutions will need to bring in third-party consultants and purchase additional software, expenses larger banks might be able to shoulder. But for smaller banks, it could force further industry consolidation, Gwaltney says. Barber, along with several other local bankers, went to Washington, D.C. in April to lobby just that message. He says lawmakers were receptive. And proof that the message was delivered came late last month in the form of a bill introduced May 21st by North Carolina Senator Tom Tillis that would delay CECL, forcing regulators to stop and study the rule before its implementation. Next, we turn to the health care and education page of this week's Triangle Business Journal. And under the heading of positive results, we see the article, Triangle Firm Moves Toward Unicorn Status with FDA Approval. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration's recent approval of a gene therapy drug could be a big break for both patients and a private Triangle company, one quickly approaching a $1 billion valuation. Asklepios Biopharmaceutical, which is based in Research Triangle Park, licenses its adeno-associated virus, or AAV, technology to companies throughout the country, as well as developing its own in-house therapeutics based on the technology. One of those companies, Illinois-based AveXis, has received FDA approval for Zolgensma, a gene therapy treatment for spinal muscular atrophy based on AskBio's license. The approval is important not only for the increased revenue for AskBio, but as a validation of the company's AAV platform and its importance in developing breakthrough treatments for rare diseases, the key to AskBio's business model. The breakthrough AAV method was first discovered by Dr. Jude Smolsky, co-founder of AskBio. The approval of Zolgensma marks the second drug to make it onto the market using AAV technology, the other being Luxturna, which treats a form of blindness. AskBio CEO Sheila McGale says the company focuses on how to make AAV delivery systems more precise and increase therapeutic potency. She says the reason Zolgensma was successful was the increased performance of the delivery set. That's our skill set, how to make these AAV viral delivery systems more effective, she says. With AveXis, we have demonstrated that we made the AAV biodelivery system more potent and efficacious. AskBio is a developer and manufacturer of gene therapy therapeutics for the treatment of rare and unusually untreatable genetic disorders. It's been quietly operating since 2001, off just $5 million in seed money, reporting positive revenue every year of its operations, according to McGale, except for last year. At the current valuation, the company is inching toward being one of the first unicorns in the life sciences field in the Triangle. The venture capital industry dubs startups as unicorns when valuation tops $1 billion. In April, the company banked $225 million in investments from Boston and Texas firms to accelerate its business, moving it into a louder and more aggressive pursuit of developing its therapeutics. Though the AAV delivery system was created by Smolsky, McHale says the company licenses it to as many interested companies as possible because there are too many areas for one firm to consider and to get as many genetic disorders treated as quickly as possible. And also on the healthcare and education page under the heading of job cuts comes the article Durham's DCRI lays off nearly 100 employees. One of the Triangle's largest contract research organizations has laid off just under 100 employees, a slash of jobs that comes during a time of increasing competition among CROs in the region. Duke Clinical Research Institute has cut 92 positions as part of a strategic planning effort in response to changes occurring across the clinical research industry, a company spokeswoman says. This planning effort determined that the DCRI needed to reduce its staff to align the size of the workforce with its current scope of studies and ensure DCRI remains at the forefront of innovation on behalf of our sponsors and partners, said Susan Landis, head of strategic communications. In March, interim executive director Leslie Curtis said cuts were coming. Prior to the round of layoffs, the company reported employing about 1,300 in the Triangle. The company has grown rapidly in the last 30 years and now occupies a prime building in the center of Durham, an iconic landmark that symbolizes both its success and that of the industry. In a March email, Curtis described a difficult situation for the company, facing challenges squarely based in the changing clinical research environment, our mix of commercial and government business, and a lag in new business at this time. Curtis offered hope based on insights from our sponsors and partners, information about opportunities where the DCRI can distinguish its services in the near future, and initial ideas for partnerships we could pursue to position the DCRI for the future. Now we turn the page to the On Real Estate page of this week's Triangle Business Journal. And under the heading of Expanding comes the article, Alabama Builder Seeks Broader Triangle Impact. Davidson Homes of Huntsville, Alabama, entered the Triangle market in 2018. Now, many of those homes are ready to sell, and the company's footprint is just getting bigger and bigger. In addition to houses and townhomes already in Apex, Holly Springs, and Wake Forest, and coming in Fuquay Varina, Davidson Homes will announce three new communities by 2020, two in southern Wake County and one in Johnston County. Adam Davidson, president and CEO of Davidson Homes, says his company has an unwavering commitment to home buyers in the area. He adds that he's committed to providing well-crafted, affordable homes to customers in the vibrant and growing Raleigh market. The company, which now has a presence in Alabama, North Carolina, and Tennessee, recently unveiled its new lineup of homes at the Hassan Tree community in Wake Forest. Davidson Homes, which has 25 lots in Hassan Tree, offers four large floor plans with open concept designs as well as large screened-in porches and three-car and golf cart garages. Houses are priced in the $460,000 to $500,000 range, with square footage ranging from 2,700 to 3,200 square feet. Hassan Tree, located in Wake Forest, features a Tom Fazio design golf course, a large clubhouse, and a swimming, tennis, and a fitness center. Davidson has also begun selling townhomes in the Bridgewater West community in Holly Springs and the Salem Creek community in Apex. And under the heading of Downtown Access comes the article, New Condos Ready for Sale Near Wake Med in Raleigh. Pre-sales are beginning on condominiums near downtown Raleigh, with prices starting at $185,000. Real estate developer Michael Sandman, who has owned the 2.4 acres at 101 Poe Drive since 2011, is developing the 176-unit Longview community with partners Andrew Sandman, Steve Simpson, and Randy Robertson. The complex is located adjacent to Wake Med Hospital. We've placed an emphasis on livability by maximizing space and functionality, Michael Sandman says. We're leading with design, not price. The move continues to push for developers into East Raleigh, an area of town that hasn't developed as fast as other parts, but that provides easy access to the center of the city. East Raleigh was once one of the city's more growing areas and includes the Raleigh Country Club. Jason Queen with Monarch Realty, the firm handling sales and marketing for Longview, says you can buy a home in the Longview for less than what you'd pay to rent a new downtown apartment. The assessed value of the vacant lot is $517,417. Construction on the first phase of development, which includes 72 units, is scheduled to begin this summer with the Longview opening in early 2021. Now we turn the page to the restaurants and retail pages. of this week's Triangle Business Journal. And first up, under the heading of Honored, comes the article, Angus Barn Owner Gets Industry Legacy Award. Angus Barn Owner Van Uhr was honored recently by the National Restaurant Association with the Industry Legends Award in Chicago. The award has only been given two other times, to Ted Ballesteri and Joe Fessler. Ballesteri is known for his work with the Sardine Factory in Monterey, California. Fessler is deputy editor at The New Food Economy. Association CEO Don Sweeney have said of Uhr, her spirit of service and optimism epitomized the best of America's restaurant industry. Her kindness, compassion, and courage have made a difference in hundreds of thousands of lives. Uhr, whose father started the Angus Barn, said, "Even though my name is on the award, it would not be possible without the help of the entire Angus Barn team that works so hard each and every day to make sure every guest has a memorable experience." And under the heading of Local Meats comes the article, Durham Food Hub Continues to Thrive. Tina Pravat-Levy and Jennifer Curtis expect the phrase food hub to start to catch on. They started First Hand Foods almost 10 years ago as a meat company that sells pasture-raised pork, beef, and lamb from North Carolina farmers to local restaurants, grocery stores, and food delivery services. A food hub is a business that manages the gathering, marketing, and distribution of meat. Food hubs help small farms thrive by providing critical regional infrastructure, including a combination of aggregation, distribution, and marketing services, Curtis says. First Hand currently works with close to 50 restaurants, including such popular establishments as Garland, St. Jacques, Bull City Burger and Brewery, Lantern, and the Saks Fifth Avenue General Store. Based in Durham, First Hand serves 22 restaurants in the Bull City alone. All our beef and pork are all third-party certified approved, so in addition to us visiting our farms every year, they go out and audit their practices, Levy says. This includes hogs having outdoor pastures. They also get a lot of exercise in the outdoor environment and don't need antibiotics or hormones, so the whole process goes a lot more naturally, and that's what humane means to us, Levy says. First Hand Foods will showcase some of its meats in the Tour de Pork in Durham from June 3rd to July 31st. There, 15 Durham restaurants will be creating a plate using various parts of the local hogs. Whether it be the loin, ham, tail, or ears, you'll find it all in a passport, or pask pork, as they call it, which will award points for all the restaurants a participant goes to. Those piggy points will get you items such as First Hand Food socks, or a sausage or deluxe steak box, depending on how much you consume. And finally, on the restaurants and retail page, under the heading of Bluegrass and Folk Focus, comes the article, Wake Forest Cafe Delivers Live Music and Lounge. Since opening its Magnolia Roots Music Lounge, the downstairs basement of Sugar Magnolia Cafe in Wake Forest has been a prized destination for people looking to listen to bluegrass and folk music without the chatter and rambunctious patrons one can encounter at a typical music venue. Selling out shows such as Jim Avett, Jill Andrews, Into the Fog, and Fireside Collective, this small-capacity venue relies on its intimate setting. There's no backstage, per se, as band members have to disembark on a 6-inch drop off the stage and exit stage right to a small area roped off by a white sheet. But it allows the musicians to interact with fans in an intimate setting. Triangle Business Journal visited Wake Forest and spent a few minutes with co-owner Howard Siddell in the lounge prior to a show. So here are a couple of questions. Tell us about how Magnolia Roots started. We teamed up with Mike Allen. He had started a group that was trying to get original live artists into different storefronts around Wake Forest. Mike introduced himself, and I was like, "Look, we're both trying to do the same thing." Most shows are on the weekends, correct? Yes, we do Fridays and Saturdays, and a lot of Thursday nights that have become ticketed shows. An artist might be doing a bigger show on the weekend, but we can get them on a Thursday. It appears most of the artists perform bluegrass, country, and folk music. My original idea was to do what Hilly Kristal at New York's CBGB's originally set out to do, country, bluegrass, and blues. I thought maybe we'll call ours BGBCs and just switch it around or something like that. I'm a big fan of that sort of roots music. Finally, tell us more about this partnership with 95.7, an internet radio station. It's a terrific station. I started hearing them and thought that they align perfectly with what we're doing. They support local bands and showcase them on air. This isn't some pirate radio. It's Capital Broadcasting. We buy spots and have a trade deal with them. We want to help them just as much as they can help us. I want to do whatever I can do, so we push them out on our newsletter and on our website. Next, we take a brief look at the Around the State page. And under the heading of Adding Jobs comes the article, Honeywell Picks Site in Charlotte for New HQ. Fortune 100 company Honeywell International, Inc. has made its headquarters official decision, committing to Legacy Union in Uptown Charlotte. The electronics manufacturer, which is relocating its corporate headquarters to Charlotte from New Jersey, will occupy about 280,000 square feet at 700 South Mint Street, the third office building to come to Lincoln Harris's 10-acre Uptown Charlotte site. Honeywell has signed a long-term lease agreement for 9 floors at the 23-story, 330,000-square-foot tower, expected to break ground in September and to be finished in the first half of 2021. Honeywell will be taking the majority of the building's leasable space, which includes 10 floors of office. The remaining floors, including ground floor retail, the lobby, and parking. John Harris, president of Lincoln Harris, said Honeywell coming to Charlotte is an extreme plus. Certainly having them choose the Legacy Union site and being part of that reiterates our thesis and what we're trying to accomplish on the site, he says. Honeywell's already begun hiring and relocating positions to Charlotte. Starting next month, Honeywell is expected to begin moving into 2 floors at 300 South Tryon, its headquarters space, until the Legacy Union Tower is finished, says Dan Kirshner, Vice President of Global Research Real Estate at Honeywell. The company says it will have 250 employees in Charlotte by September. The company said in November it would relocate its headquarters to Charlotte, a move that will result in at least 750 jobs here by the end of 2024. The relocation was aided by nearly $42.5 million from the state's Job Development Investment Grant, and another $28.9 million from Mecklenburg County, and $17.1 million from the City of Charlotte, a combined business investment program grant that's the largest offered to date. Honeywell has spent the past 9 months looking at office options in Charlotte. Initially, the company looked everywhere, but eventually zeroed in on Uptown and South End. The company landed on Legacy Union because of the success thus far of the project and Lincoln Harris's reputation of being able to deliver, Kirshner said. Now we turn to this week's cover story for the Triangle Business Journal, and it's entitled History's Last Gasp, How NC Mutual Life Insurance Company is Desperately Trying to Stay Relevant. The lights could be dimming at a cornerstone of what's known as Black Wall Street, North Carolina Mutual Insurance Company. And there's more at stake than just numbers on a balance sheet for a company trying to straddle its 120-year history with the changing needs of customers. The firm, founded by a barber and a doctor in 1898, is more than just the oldest insurance company in the state. According to historians, NC Mutual is the only remaining insurance company in the United States that's historically black-owned. And its dissolution would be culturally catastrophic, they say. It's always been a symbol and very much a source of pride within the framework of the African-American community, says North Carolina Central University historian Andre Devan. Few current and past employees will go on record to talk about the current financial situation, something that doesn't surprise NCCU business professor Henry McCoy. He says failure would be taken personally by the community that has counted on NC Mutual as a symbol of success for generations. The company's history has been validating to generations of black entrepreneurs, consistently trying to prove themselves against mounting odds. That symbol, however, is in danger of losing its identity, as alleged misappropriation cost the company millions and put it in danger of insolvency, records show. It's a situation that could happen to any historic institution, as low cash reserves leave little margin for error, and modern technologies require constant investments. All that stands between NC Mutual and potential dissolution are state regulators, who have said in filings that saving the company could mean selling it piece by piece. Following a sealed December court order, the firm has been under the purview of Commissioner Mike Causey of the North Carolina Department of Insurance. Recent documents show it's likely NCDOI will break up the company as it works to make it solvent. Facing that reality, an effort's underway to save the brand that some say is more about the community than NC Mutual's bottom line. Quietly, Wake County Superior Court Judge Graham Shirley issued what's called an order of rehabilitation against the company last year, appointing Causey and his deputies as rehabilitator. In recent weeks, NCDOI, via required paperwork, claims it's taken possession of all known assets and property of the company and is evaluating its options. It's hard for past employees to contemplate, they say. Part of the reason for that is the culture that's long been in place at the firm, one where management communicated that NC Mutual wasn't just about numbers and assets. There was this intangible feeling of being at an institution that served African Americans, and the unique interest the company had in that mission, recalls former Chief Marketing Officer Kimberly Williams Moore, who spent nearly 15 years at the company. You just realize it's so much bigger. It's about African American social uplift. Konia Watson, who retired nearly 30 years ago and currently leads the retiree group North Carolina Mutual and former employees, says that mission has been there since the beginning. It's always been more than an insurance company, he says. It participated and supported many of the projects that were undertaken here in Durham. Moore has hope that, even in rehabilitation, the mission can survive. I believe it's a reorganization, and they can keep that mission, she says. We had a great opportunity to work with other companies who organized, and when it's a part of what you do, I believe the company can keep that mission. They are committed. In a statement, NCDOI claims the most significant issue impacting NC Mutual is a reinsurance transaction, that's insurance purchased by an insurance company, where the assets securing the deal were misappropriated by an investment manager. NC Mutual is attempting to recover these assets through all means available, including litigation, NCDOI states. Until these assets are recovered and NC Mutual's financial condition is stabilized, the company will remain in receivership for the protection of policyholders and other creditors. Causey, through a spokeswoman, declined to comment. A federal court case filed in 2016 outlines the details of how NC Mutual alleges it entrusted a group of companies and individuals with investing and holding a sizable amount of assets, but instead claimed to have discovered they were engaged in a fraudulent scheme. NC Mutual claims a firm called Forefront Capital Holdings altered and/or forged an investment agreement to include other parties, and then, presumably relying on the fraudulent investment advisory agreement, invested virtually all of North Carolina Mutual cash and assets that were either directly or indirectly linked to the Forefront entities. Other defendants in the case included Stamford Brook Capital, Port Royal Reassurance Company, Summit Trust Company, Forefront Capital, Bradley Reifler, and Michael Flatley. As of last month, NC Mutual had obtained entries of default against five corporate defendants and one of the individual defendants. And separately, NC Mutual had won an order forcing a judgment in a bankruptcy case against Reifler. They've all either declined to comment on the case or not returned inquiries to talk about the situation. But much of the damage has been done, filings show. Businesses have bad actors, says Moore, declining to comment specifically on the case. We don't have hundreds of people there. We have less than 200 people. The concentration of decision-making can be a challenge. As can a pivot without the significant cash reserves of its insurance peers, she says. Moore says the odds were against NC Mutual long before the misappropriation allegations, pointing to how it was founded from a negative position more than 100 years ago. It had $750 period, she says. You look at Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, they had millions to start. I always impress upon people that when you have $750 at your first check to start your company, and you go into an industry that has millions of dollars to start, you see why people don't make it. Ascensi Mutual is rehabilitated by state regulators. The executive management team, including former president and CEO Michael Lawrence, are out, confirms NCDOI. And they either could not be reached for comment or declined to talk about the bank, citing the pending litigation. For more, it was a choice when she left last November, she says. We knew the company was struggling financially, she says. I personally believe the officers, like myself, made a choice, acknowledging that it's going to take a major shift, a major change, and it meant seeing some of us leaving on our own. Documents show the rehabilitator is evaluating just such change. The state is moving ahead in a process that could sell off chunks of the firm. According to the latest monthly report filed in May, three letters of intent have been received proposing the purchase of NC Mutual's wholly owned subsidiary, North Carolina Mutual Financial. While one of these letters has been withdrawn, NCDOI is evaluating the other two offers and will negotiate towards reaching a mutually acceptable transaction. The office is also looking at the operations of the other subsidiary, North Carolina Mutual Insurance Agency, to determine the appropriate disposition of this asset. And an unsolicited offer was made to purchase a portion of the firm's mortgage loan portfolio. The office is working to identify other potential parties that might be interested in acquiring all or a portion of the mortgage loan portfolio before making any decisions. And documents show other parts of the business are being evaluated for potential sale too, such as real property and NC Mutual's in-force business and reinsurance programs. A non-disclosure agreement has been entered into with an unidentified party that has expressed a potential interest in making an investment in NC Mutual. And as that's going on, the office is looking to cut the company's expenses, such as negotiating contract terms and canceling unnecessary services, such as staff-issued cell phones. Staff cuts, too, are part of the plan, as a 7-position reduction has already resulted in $1.1 million in annual savings. In a letter to policyholders, NCDOI states its goal to return the company to solvency and to a condition where all contractual claims of policyholders can be honored by the company. As it works out its issues, NC Mutual is not issuing new policies. Surrenders and loans will be allowed on a case-by-case basis for genuine hardship situations. According to NCDOI, rehabilitation, not liquidation, is a policyholder's best chance to receive full benefits. That's because state guarantee associations impose limits on cash surrender values and death benefits. While in the event of a liquidation, some of the claims of NC Mutual's policyholders would be covered by various state guarantee associations, there's a chance that not all will be, NCDOI states in a letter to policyholders in February. Liquidation would also end the only insurance company domiciled in North Carolina with a charter dating before 1900. The company, credited as being the oldest and largest African-American life insurance company in the United States, was led by men who would leave lasting legacies on their city, people such as Charles C. Spaulding, John Merrick, and Dr. Aaron Moore. Durham's Eileen Watts Welch, the great-granddaughter of both Merrick and Moore, has grown up with their legacy, even though her family is no longer directly involved with the company. Their story is one of personal pride and a narrative she lived. They were providing a service to a population that couldn't access those services in any other way, she says. NC Mutual spawned a lot of other opportunities for African Americans in Durham. Welch grew up with her grandmother in NC Mutual's ladies' chorus, eating family lunches at the firm's dining hall, which for many years was the only eatery open to African Americans in downtown Durham. She recalls driving down Highway 147 with her mother. Even in her later days, she would say, "There's the Mutual." Merrick, born into slavery in Sampson County, moved to Chapel Hill with his mother at age 12, working in a brickyard and going on to establish himself as a brick mason, and later a prolific barber with 5 barbershops in Durham. But his entrepreneurial ambitions expanded over the years. Merrick helped create fraternal insurance company Royal Knights of King David. In 1898, He and that group of businessmen, including Durham physician Moore, founded what became North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance Company, putting up a few dollars apiece to start up the company, says McCoy. Merrick served as its president until he died in 1919. Aaron Moore had this sort of understanding of the needs of his patients and the needs of his community, says Welch, who is collaborating on a book about a great-grandfather. He thought of them as his people. Moore practiced medicine in his home because there wasn't a hospital for African Americans, she says. His back porch served as a de facto hospital until he helped create what would become Lincoln Hospital. He had the uncanny ability to recognize potential, Welch says, pointing to a visit Moore had with his nephew in Columbus County. The boy was working in a store, making change without counting on his fingers. So Moore looked at his family and said, "What are you going to do with that boy? He doesn't belong on a farm." He put him on a train, and that boy, Asa Spaulding, became the first African-American actuary at Moore's insurance company. But it's hard to put 21st century context a substantial risk for people like Moore in creating and seeing Mutual, McCoy notes. A few hours away in Wilmington, race riots were taking place, and African-American businesses were being overrun. And challenging NC Mutual's mission was that scholarship at the time made several false and offensive allegations about African-Americans. McCoy points to ideas accepted by many as fact at the time that African-Americans had shorter life expectancies. It was easier to insure a horse than it was to insure an African-American, he said. There were so-called scientists who put out reports claiming black people were somehow different, not fully human. NC Mutual offered a policy and dignity, he says, and it had virtually no competition in its earliest days in the African-American community. It stepped into a gap that was there, McCoy says. As it grew, its executives were instrumental in the growth of Durham's black community, the company claims, pointing to White Rock Baptist Church, Lincoln Hospital, and NC Central University as some of their lasting initiatives. McCoy notes that it invested in minority businesses, playing a dynamic role in growing Black Wall Street and beyond. It instituted a strict dress code requiring etiquette from its employees, not just sale numbers. They knew it was at the center of the African-American universe, McCoy says. They were being watched. They wanted to make sure everyone associated with NC Mutual represented the firm well, by the way they talked and the way they dressed. That culture would continue. "It was like we were going to Wall Street," Moore describes of the dress code. "I got up in the morning, and it wasn't about selling life insurance. It was about giving hope to a generation. You would think these are archaic issues, but you can tell in the news it's not." But despite the changing times, its business challenges never left. Welch recalls overhearing phone conversations as a child, a former NC Mutual president, Bill Kennedy Jr., talking about ways to address the market and ways to offset the losses. "How do you address that without losing your identity?" she says. "You open it to everybody, and you compete with big companies with much higher capital. You could get business loans, but back then it was NC Mutual giving out the business loans." When integration hit, a common perception was that the economics would flow both ways. While African-American companies lost market share to historically white competitors, the reverse just didn't happen, McCoy says. Minority-owned businesses typically have a harder time getting access to capital, and NC Mutual was no exception, he says. They, like all companies in the sector, needed to update their technology and products to compete. And that's challenging when a company is trying to keep its legacy intact. That balance between keeping historic legacy but also being able to reach a broader market is an important one, McCoy says. NC Mutual's position wasn't unique, he says, noting that in the 1970s, there were 50 or so black insurance firms, all steadily losing market share. By the end of the 20th century, there may have been 25, he says. Now here we are. It's gotten down to North Carolina Mutual. Of the five largest black insurers in 2000, identified through the 2001 Black Enterprise 100 Largest Companies list, just NC Mutual remains as it was. NC Mutual has help. In filings released in May, NCDOI claims it has made substantial investments in technology upgrades that have cut expenses. But an activity report from April 30th reads, a final decision as to the course of action to take with NC Mutual has not yet been determined. Regardless of the company's survival, some insist the brand itself isn't going anywhere. That includes Carl Webb, founder of 40 AM, which has been revamping the historic building that houses NC Mutual's headquarters. When the 14-story building was constructed in 1963, it was reported to be the tallest building owned by any black business in the United States. Webb intends to preserve the symbol he says it's become, adding new lighting to the historic sign. His goal is to create a district we call the Mutual District, in order to tell the story of what this tobacco farmer and this formerly enslaved black man did. For Webb, the effort to maintain the brand is a personal mission. He grew up in Durham, going to NC Mutual on class field trips. He credits his story as one that inspired him. He says the issues facing NC Mutual should concern every business owner in Durham. Black-owned businesses have struggled in ways we should be concerned about in North Carolina, he says, calling them underrepresented. Just 4% of downtown Durham businesses are black-owned, he adds. There's a bigger issue that we as a state and a business community should elevate, so I feel concerned about the NC Mutual situation. Webb says the community, not just Causey, has a responsibility to learn from the situation and invest. That's why he started co-working space Provident in 1998, inspired by NC Mutual's original name, which was the North Carolina Mutual and Provident Company, and founding date. It's our effort to create the next big thing, an opportunity for the next generation of entrepreneurs and creators to come up with something that might live 100 years like NC Mutual, he said. Now, as we turn to this week's Viewpoint page, we read the guest editorial from Billy Arsamont. Arsamont's a professional speaker, consultant, performance coach, and founder of the Results Group. His article is entitled, What Great Leaders Really Have in Common. Not everyone can lead. Not everyone deserves to lead. Great leaders belong to a special group of people. Their example becomes a model by which others learn the elements of leadership. It's an awesome responsibility to lead, so it behooves one to get it right. Like any effort that becomes successful, one must first want to lead. Outstanding leaders love to serve and aid others to reach their potential. Leadership is not a selfish act, nor is it self-serving. It's service by another name. I've had the privilege to meet some very successful individuals in my life that also exemplified great leadership skills. Among them, Zig Ziglar, one of the best sales trainers ever. Og Mandino, a magnificent writer. The Chicken Soup book authors, Jack Canfield and Mark Victor Hansen. The dynamic Dr. Norman Vincent Peale. Astronaut trainer Dr. Dennis Waitley. One of my childhood motivational messengers, Earl Nightingale. And former President Gerald Ford. Besides all being great leaders, there's a common trait they have, which may surprise you. Each in their own way displays a high degree of humility. Most might feel this a strange trait for people that have achieved such fame. Gerald Ford's the individual with the highest job profile I ever met. He was also one of the most humble. I had the privilege to be part of a small group of business leaders that met with Ford. The humility he displayed was stunning to witness. I was surprised at the first words he spoke when we met him at the airport. As he was exiting the plane, he said, "You fellows didn't have to go to all this trouble for me." Unbelievable is a better descriptor. Stephen Covey has an excellent book, Principle-Centered Leadership, that discusses the use of principles. Such leaders have a solid game plan for carrying out their responsibilities. They have identified their conscience and make every effort to not ignore what it tells them to do. Great leaders, first of all, have a conscience. Then all their actions are consistent with the principles comprising it. So there are key ideas to remember. One, stay humble. You're not as important as your mind is telling you. Two, arrogance is the end result of loving yourself or believing yourself above others. Ignore number two, but never number one. Three, listen to learn. Listen to experience the greatest conversations. Listen and lead at the highest level. And finally, four, ask, what do I stand for? Define positions that are cast in stone and define who you are. Clarity brings success. Principles offer clarity and success. This week's editor's notebook is entitled New Rules for Lenders and Brokers Send Mixed Signals. The next time a broker is walking you through a series of investment opportunities, you may really have to read the fine print closely. That's because the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission finalized new sets of rules that the agency says are necessary to protect investors from a stockbroker's potential conflict of interest. But there's a good chance these rules may fall short in the end. Under the agency's regulation best interest policy, brokers would be required to act in the best interest of clients and let investors know about pay incentives tied to particular stocks, bonds, or other financial security. The brokerage industry believes these rules set a higher standard than the current rule, which only asks brokers to run through a suitability factor test after reviewing a client's goals and tolerance for risks. Well, all that sounds good, but with one exception. Some of the new rules can be met if brokers just disclose them in writing. So it's not that your broker would have to say, listen, you should invest in this fund, but also know they will pay me an extra 2% in commissions if I sell a certain amount. If these potential conflicts are being disclosed in writing, who wants to take a guess as to the point size of that disclosure typeface? To me, that provision should have been eliminated. Instead, what the SEC should have done is forced the brokers to talk about the pay or incentive relationship with companies and then make the client sign paperwork that stated the discussion took place verbally. On the other hand, the Financial Accounting Standards Board is looking at revising the board's current expected credit loss standard that has community banks and credit unions calling foul. Why? Because the new rule will force lending institutions to record the expected credit loss over the life of the loan right away. Under the current rule, institutions could spread the expected loss over the life of the loan. The rule is set to be enacted in 2021, but community banks and credit unions are putting a lot of pressure on Capitol Hill to thwart the effort until a detailed study of the effects is completed, a process supported by some U.S. senators, including North Carolina's Tom Tillis. To me, all it will do is hurt small businesses. As it is, getting a loan is tough, and the need for collateral and other guarantees are so steep that many businesses simply don't qualify. If a lender is required to post the estimated credit loss of that loan all at once, they're going to be more reluctant to make that loan. FASB's point is they don't want to be caught flat-footed when the economy sours and loans start defaulting. This way, the lending institutions would have the reserve to cover those losses. Again, good on principle, bad on process. The SEC and FASB are honorable organizations that, for the most part, are looking to protect the U.S. taxpayer. But in most cases, one has to experience a full economic cycle to adopt new rules. We're running on more than 10 years of economic expansion. We've forgotten what's on the other side. Well, that music means we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be certain to listen next time. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long till next time. If you have comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.